Today at Reader's Corner, Jill Gill, author of Embattled Ecumenism, The National Council of Churches, The Vietnam War, and The Trials of the Protestant Left.
They were the big dogs, the National Council of Churches. In 1965, they felt like they were important leaders that brought an important voice to government. If they set their mind to something, they felt like they could have an impact. Ecumenism at its heart really emphasizes theology, but one of the problems that the NCC had in the 1960s is that the crisis nature of the issues they were dealing with did overwhelm theological discussion. Look at today, the partisanship. Congress can't even talk among their own divisions. And here are these ecumenists that do the bridge-building thing 24/7. They're good at it. They have a skill set that is direly needed today.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In modern America, religious interest and national politics are often intertwined. But many listeners may not realize that before Jerry Falwell's moral majority helped fuel the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, Christian influence on American politics was almost entirely the realm of liberals and progressives cloaked in the robes of ecumenism, a philosophy that emphasized unity and interdependence among not only Christians, but all of humanity. In a new book, historian Jill Gill describes how the National Council of Churches, a once powerful alliance of Christian denominations that shared the ecumenical vision, was largely broken up by the turbulence of the Vietnam War era. Dr. Gill is a history professor at Boise State University and the author of Embattled Ecumenism, The National Council of Churches, The Vietnam War, and The Trials of the Protestant Left. Her book details the rapid decline of this well-organized and well-financed group that for generations wielded an extraordinary liberal influence over American politics and opinion, including the policies of FDR's New Deal and LBJ's Great Society. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Gill. She joined us in the studio for this interview. Jill Gill, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's start with that definition. I gave a very snappy definition of ecumenism. Maybe you should start us off by helping us understand more about the National Council of Churches in light of their ecumenical drive of those days.
The word ecumenical is not used very often. If it gets used in common parlance, it's often used as a synonym for collaboration or cooperation. And that really doesn't capture what ecumenism meant for folks who are part of an ecumenical movement. And you hit the key word. It's about unity, and it's about seeing the body of Christ as interconnected, interdependent parts, almost like parts of a mosaic. And most ecumenists think that when God looks at the fractured nature of ecumenism, God sees a picture, an interconnected picture. And so ecumenists believe that if they're going to understand the mind of God, if they're going to understand truly how to unpack the Bible and how it should be applied to the world today, they have to listen to one another because no single group of the Christian community has all the answers. They need each other. And so they have to talk across these very difficult divisions of language and ecclesial structures and culture and class and race and different parts of the world so that they can better understand what God commands them to do. This requires great humility. It requires an open mind. It requires the ability to change. And so renewal is also part of the ecumenical vision. The National Council of Churches is an organization that was designed to help facilitate this. And there are many around the world. The United States has the National Council of Churches, but there's a Canadian Council of Churches. There's an Australian Council of Churches. There's councils of churches all across Asia, Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, and then there's a World Council of Churches. And these guys try to do ecumenical work. It also allows them, of course, to bring their resources together and make a bigger impact on the world, which seems to be harder and harder for churches to do.
Well, one of the things we're going to be talking about this half hour is how the National Council of Churches has lost some of its clout that it had in the 1960s. And you point out 1965 was its halcyon year. Yeah. Now that you mention these other Council of Churches, how are they faring compared to what has happened to the National Council of Churches?
Oh, that's a good question. And I'm not an expert in that. I do know that the World Council of Churches is suffering in some of the same ways for the same reason. Money gets tight. And one of the things that happens for these ecumenists who are constantly listening to one another and embracing pluralism the way they are, they believe they should have a prophetic voice, and it often puts them in a position where they're speaking ahead of where most of their masses are, no matter what country they're in. The British Council of Churches was against the Vietnam War when the British government was staying quiet. The Japanese Council of Churches was against the war when their own country didn't want to say anything. So these councils of churches stick their necks out, and I think they pay the same kind of a price that folks in the National Council of Churches did.
I think you point out in your book that the National Council of Churches at one time represented over 30 different Protestant and Orthodox denominations. Maybe we should focus a little bit on who they are not, who's outside of the scope of the National Council of Churches. So I assume, for example, that the evangelicals, the fundamentalists, the churches that are getting all the attention these days and that are very political, those clearly are not part of this ecumenism movement.
That's correct. In fact, not only are they not part of it, throughout most of the history of the 20th century, they've been opposed to it. Mm-hmm. These are folks who think they do have the answers and that it's about trying to convert other people and give them the truth that they know. They saw the National Council of Churches as very dangerous, as slipping too far politically towards socialism and too far religiously towards secularism. So yes, you're absolutely right. Evangelicals have a different way of being Christian, and fundamentalists as well. And so they've been oppositional. In fact, they created their own organizations, the National Association of Evangelicals in the mid part of the 20th century. The fundamentalists created an organization that were designed to oppose the National Council of Churches and its efforts. So yes, the Pentecostals tend to be on the outside of this group, the Southern Baptist Convention. They have found ways in current day to cooperate on some things. They're cooperating now a little bit on the environment. And they've cooperated a little bit on poverty. And the ecumenical groups continue to reach out to the evangelicals to try to find ways to cooperate. But it's been tense. And evangelicals look suspiciously at the ecumenical churches.
So take us back to the mid-1960s, which apparently was the high water mark for the power and the influence of the National Council of Churches. Describe for us how they were powerful. In what ways were they powerful?
They were hegemonic, if you will, in terms of the culture and politics. They were the go-to group for the White House. If the White House wanted to woo religious support for their policies, if they wanted to reach the masses, they went to the National Council of Churches. Presidents, secretaries of state would eagerly seek out opportunities to speak to the National Council of Churches at their conventions. And the evangelicals at this point were somewhat suspicious of politics as being a little bit too secular. Not that they didn't put their voice out there, but they kind of purposefully self-marginalized a little bit, something they feel like was a mistake. By the time you get into the 60s and 70s and 80s, they start to push themselves in. So they were the big dogs, the National Council of Churches. And in 1965, they felt quite powerful, muscular, a little bit triumphal about what impact they could have on policy and American life. They felt like they were important leaders that brought an important voice to government that government needed and wanted. So they felt like they could make a difference in 1965. If they set their mind to something, they felt like they could have an impact.
And what kind of policies did they become involved in?
In the mid-60s, they were involved with the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Supporting that was in the Kennedy administration. They got very active in civil rights. I think of all the issues of the 60s, that was the thing that became most important to them. But second most important to them was getting more involved in foreign policy. The Vietnam War became ever more important. They spoke out against McCarthyism. They were anti-communists, but they felt that McCarthyism was destroying the very freedom that America was trying to preserve. Peace and social justice was primarily what they focused on because they believed that they needed to be the hands of Jesus in the world. And so their policy perspectives reflected that priority.
You're listening to Jill Gill. She's a professor of history at Boise State University and the author of Embattled Ecumenism. I may have missed something either in my reflections on that era or in reading your book, but what strikes me as really interesting is that from my recollection of that time frame, if you were to ask me to name one personality, I'd say Billy Graham. Yeah. Billy Graham was everywhere. Every time an American president got up to do something, Billy Graham was right there to bless him, almost regardless of the partisan affiliation of the president. But on the other hand, I don't remember any great, powerful personality representing the National Council of Churches in all those years. And I guess the most important question is, does that say anything about what eventually happened to the National Council of Churches, that you had this great bureaucratic movement, but
There didn't seem to be any great savior who I mean, there were theologians like Niebuhr, I guess, that you could point to as folks that public policymakers would rely on occasionally. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, it's a great observation, and it is very telling. It tells us something about what holds together groups that are ecumenical. They're not held together by personalities. They never have been. And sociologists of religion have basically said that the mainline Protestant churches, when they do the good works of Christ out in the world, they like to be behind the scenes. They're not flashy folks. They're not folks that are doing television ministries. They're not on the radio a whole lot. They work behind the scenes in a workmanlike way to try to bring peace with justice. And that may have something to do with the fact that evangelicals are about proselytizing. That's the core of what it means to be evangelical, is to evangelize. So personality and being good with media and getting your face out there, being able to translate your message into very accessible types of communication that attract the masses, that's what they're good at. The evangelicals, hands down, have been better at communication than the ecumenical folks. But they don't want necessarily the limelight. They just want to have an impact. And so they kind of worked behind the scenes. They're kind of eggheady, too. They come out of academic backgrounds, a lot of them. A lot of them have PhDs and, you know, worked in government, but often behind the scenes. So, yeah, they don't get well known, but they hope to try to make an impact nevertheless through their channels, through their networks, and so on. But it's been challenging for them because of exactly what you point out. Mm-hmm. Billy Graham was the face of a lot of what people thought was Christianity in the 1950s and 60s, for sure.
Now, obviously, these folks who were involved with the National Council of Churches, these many denominations, had their political differences. What about their theological differences? I mean, these are different denominations who think differently about the relationship to God. Did that weigh into this, or did they lay that aside and pretty much focus on public policy, let's say?
Ecumenism at its heart, in its process, really emphasizes theology. But one of the problems that some people said that the NCC had in the 1960s is that the crisis nature of the issues they were dealing with did overwhelm theological discussion. They did try to facilitate that, but there was a type of theology at the time that was coming out. It was kind of hot in a lot of the Protestant seminaries about kind of action theology, that you act your way into thinking. And those kind of pressures sublimated some of the theological discussion that other leaders within the council felt was getting lost, that you need to know your mind with respect to theology before you can act. And so I don't know if it was necessarily certain denominations, but there were certain ecumenists that felt like theology was getting sacrificed a little bit because these crisis issues were becoming so strong and because some people felt so passionate about them, and particularly young people who were active in the ecumenical movement, just wanted to get out there and march with God in the streets. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where God was moving. God wasn't moving behind the stained glass windows, you know, in rooms where academics are parsing Greek, you know, interpretations right. Or Latin interpretations of the Bible. God's out there with African Americans who are marching. God is out there with the people who are trying to get Honeywell to stop producing napalm. I mean, so some people would say that theology didn't have the forefront that it should have.
So what was the Christian right doing at this time?
Well, the Christian right was on the two big issues of the 1960s. And this is important for understanding the rise of the religious right and the decline of the religious left. There's this kind of this dialectical relationship that's happening between left and right. The choices of the left are affecting the choices of the right. And so the right is on race. They're kind of standing where their parishioners are at. They're not really in favor of the civil rights movement. They were getting to the point where they could admit that racism as an attitude should be adjusted. But boy, when you talk about systemic change with regard to race, they were resistant to that, and so were many of their parishioners. With respect to issues like the Vietnam War, hey, you know, love it or leave it, baby. You know, my country, right or wrong, America's God's right arm in the world. We are an exceptional nation with a mission from God that goes back to our very founding. And so you know, these communists that were fighting in Vietnam are atheists. They've been killing Christian missionaries. They're driving the church out of their lands. All things that were true. But that this war is godly. It's part of a spiritual battle that's going on. So they supported this war. And they also supported and reflected people's understandings of their country and an understanding of their country that they truly wanted to hang on to. I mean, made people feel very special and very proud of their nation. So they're standing on that side. The NCC is raising questions about those things that come out of their discussions with a more pluralistic religious environment and world.
Let me pick up on that point you made about the Christian right leadership sticking with where its parishioners were. In a sense, didn't I read in your book that when it comes to the National Council of Churches and its leadership, it may well have gotten way ahead of where those Protestant flocks were when it comes to the Vietnam War issue, for example?
They certainly did. It's called the clergy-laity gap, and it's one of the things that scholars have been trying to parse and figure out for a long time, because it really is one of the keys for understanding the decline of the religious left. Although I don't think a lot of ecumenists would say they were wrong in doing it, because part of being the church, they felt, was being prophetic. And a lot of these church leaders had the advantage of being able to travel around the world and actually talk to Asian Christians that were feeling the backside of the Vietnam War. They were the ones that had the bombs dropped on them. They had an opportunity to talk to African Christians and such. And so they felt like it was the job of the church to speak truth to power. That's a Quaker phrase. And to be that prophetic Jeremiah in the wilderness that is calling us to question. And that's the role of the church. When the church is at its best, it's being prophetic. Well, a lot of the American public, the folks sitting in the pews, they didn't have that opportunity. They grew up with a fairly traditional view of what Christianity was about, and they came to church primarily for a one-to-one belief to figure out where they were going when they died and to find comfort and a nice place to bring your kids on Sunday. And all of a sudden, these ecumenical leaders are talking politics. And they didn't feel like they were having their needs met. They felt like, you know, maybe their leaders loved the Vietnamese more than they loved them. And they weren't reflecting their values. They believed what Lyndon Johnson said were the reasons for going into Vietnam. They didn't know any different. They were trusting what was coming through the news media. The ecumenical churches had their own sources of information. I mean, that's one thing about the National Council of Churches. When you're dealing with a global faith, they don't have to depend on State Department white papers for what's going on overseas. They don't have to depend on the news media. They had people on the ground that could give them lots of information. And so they were operating, I think, on a wider body of data. But they couldn't bring their people along quick enough or fast enough. And yeah, a lot of their folks got mad at them. You know, the 60s, the mantra is question authority, right? That's not just
That's
the
right.
kids.
That's exactly
That's the people in the pews were questioning authority, too. And it came back to bite the National Council in terms of numbers and loyalty and discontent. But still, when I interviewed those folks who did it, they said we were right to do it. Because look at where America is today. America today is basically, we look back at what the National Council said on race, and they agree with them. When we look back on what happened with regard to Vietnam, even evangelicals today will concede that these ecumenical leaders were right. They even concede that the National Council of Churches was right on the environment. So they were foresightful, but they sure got burned, you know, back when it was unpopular to stick their necks out. But they helped change America.
Is it possible that these Protestant leaders, by getting ahead of their flocks, bear some of the responsibility for the fall off in membership over the years? Or, I mean, there's so many other good reasons we could cite why church membership has fallen off. But I just wondered if anybody has calculated that into the answer.
I think as a historian, I think it's part of it. But we would be wrong to say that that's the whole picture. Actually, the greatest drop-off of members for liberal congregations is not people running from the left to the right. Actually, it's young people going from the Protestant left to secularism. The Protestant left has not held on to its young people. And in the 1960s, the young people were saying these kind of lumbering, heavy, slow church bureaucracies are not moving quick enough for us on race, Vietnam, the environment, women's issues, and so on. So a lot of the kids, they join secular groups, and they've never really come back. And the other thing about the ecumenical churches is they don't focus as hard as the religious right on keeping the youth that they have. And that's because they have kind of a universalist view of salvation. They don't think that the Methodists or the Presbyterians or Catholics have all the right answers. There's many ways to God, many paths. And so they say to Johnny or Susie, we raised you Methodist, but if you want to explore, if you want to become Buddhist, if you want to become one of those folks that calls themselves spiritual but not religious, you can find God in those ways. So there's not the peer pressure from family to stay within the flock. So the kids are moving further to the left. And yes, they did alienate some of their older, more traditional members who started withdrawing funds and started to speak out. And they may have gone somewhat into the right. There's more than just that to explain the decline. There's these demographic issues. The left has less children than the right, and I think that's another issue.
You're listening to Jill Gill. She's a professor of history at Boise State University and the author of Embattled Ecumenism, The National Council of Churches, the Vietnam War, and the Trials of the Protestant Left. I believe I got the quote right in your book. Say, Vietnam exposed and exacerbated factionalism within ecumenism. What help us understand the internal divisions within the National Council of Churches that perhaps the council could have overcome were it not for the Vietnam War?
Well, yeah, the 60s was such a chaotic period that it couldn't hold off the kinds of divisive questions on the outside that came right into the council. So some of the factions that it divided were obviously the clergy-laity gap. I mean, it exploded that because it was this crisis that moved the churches more quickly, at least the leadership, in the direction that the laity couldn't follow, and that was the greatest division. Another division was between these traditional ecumenists who felt, as we've talked about, theology should precede action, versus these new, what they called new breed clergy that believe that you act your way into thinking, and they just want to jump out there and do action sermons, as they called it, you know. So that was another division that got heightened. Then there was a fascinating division that sparked off between the relief branch of the churches, the mission and relief branch, the ones that go out and give food and clothes to refugees and so on, versus the branch of the churches that is trying to put a Christian voice into politics. The relief branch, in order to do its good work in Vietnam, which was taking care of the refugees created by the war, they had to work through the logistics of the U.S. government to even get food in. And the government used that power to try to co-opt the good works of the churches to help make the war seem more compassionate and good for the people of Vietnam. They tried to co-opt the churches into the pacification effort. So whereas the relief wing is kind of cautious about criticizing the government because the government's critical for doing their work, the arm of the churches that was doing the political stuff felt that that was hurting their image because they're trying to keep an ecumenical identity with the developing world, which is critical of Vietnam. And here their relief wing is out there working with the government
really
in the pacification.
Yeah.
And so that exploded. And that tension lasted for decades beyond the Vietnam War. And it ultimately, the relief wing of the National Council of Churches in 2000 split off. They never could heal that breach.
Tell us about the relationship of the National Council to the American presidency, to the White House. You mentioned earlier that when it comes to civil rights, for example, I would think that LBJ and the National Council would be best of friends.
They were.
But obviously, with LBJ's Vietnam policy, that was all to change. And you mentioned a guy in the National Council, the International Affairs Director, Robert Bilheimer, had something to do with how the White House relationship fell apart.
I think the position of the ecumenical churches to government is join it where you can, where your theology matches policy, and support it, but criticize it where you must, and never be, as much as you can, co-opted by government. Never get into a quid pro quo relationship with government. Otherwise, the church loses its power to be a prophetic voice, which is its ultimate power in the world. So, yes, on civil rights, they collaborated, and on Vietnam, they began to slowly, steadily realize that they couldn't. And, you know, Johnson was one of those politicians that, man, if you bite the hand that feeds you, he's going to shove you out the door fairly quickly. And so that kind of broke the relationship that they had. Martin Luther King did the exact same thing, right? He knew that he was going to be persona non grata as soon as he spoke out on Vietnam. That's exactly what happened in 1967. They're taking risks. They're making choices that our relationship with government is not as important as speaking truth to power. And, of course, they did pay the political price. There's a political price for being a prophetic voice. With Nixon, of course, it got even worse. There's two things that I've learned that government wants out of the churches from an expedient perspective. One is they want the churches to give them God cover. That means legitimate our policies in a theological and Christian kind of a way. And then the second thing is because churches are so connected to the populace, they can deliver votes if you get in good with them, mm-hmm. right? So once Nixon realized that the mainline Protestant churches weren't going to give him either of those things, and they had become sort of what Dean Russ called generals without armies because they were losing their pew people, he started to look for another group that could give him the God cover that he wanted and deliver votes. And his old buddy, Billy Graham, was there. And in hindsight, you know, Billy Graham, when he looks back, he felt a little bit used by Nixon. But they delivered the moral legitimacy that the Nixon administration wanted with respect to Vietnam. Also, you frankly gave the more conservative people in the pews kind of a God cover to not really have to challenge themselves more than they wanted to on their perspectives of race and not to have to necessarily give up their exceptionalist views of America because here's Billy Graham saying you're okay. Mm-hmm. And that's that dialectic that the conservative churches kind of benefited from the risks that the ecumenical churches took because then they could cozy up to the government at the same time that the Republican Party needed a religious voice to stand next to them. And then that is sort of the beginning of the kind of marriage that we see between the religious right and the Republican Party that really gets glued in under Reagan and continued all the way through George W. Bush.
So the next phase of religious involvement in America after this decade or so that you've studied is Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority. What did Jerry Falwell learn from the NCC model?
Well, he ends up, I mean, he, before he created the Moral Majority, he was one of the most vociferous critics of the National Council of Churches and churches getting involved in politics. He thought that the job of churches was to just be spiritual, to save souls. And he criticized the council for, you know, getting its hands into secularism because politics was secularism. They don't have the expertise to do it. But boy, Jerry Falwell changed his tune pretty well when he got his hands around some issues that corresponded with his own theology. And then he became quite a proponent. In fact, boy, in the 1980s and 1990s, he even was criticizing Billy Graham for not being political enough. And he believed that it was his job to lobby Congress on behalf of his Christian values and to mobilize voters on behalf of his Christian values, that politics was exactly the place that churches should use their free speech rights. So he flipped very quickly once the issues lined up with his Christian beliefs.
And one final question. Was the National Council of Churches simply a product of its time and place in history, or is it possible that we might see it resurrected in some way? Historians are supposed to do better, I guess, looking at the past and constructing from it what the future is. But I know you're not, you don't have a crystal ball here on the desk that I can see. What's your thoughts?
I think it's possible. And, you know, I think the structures, the ecumenical conciliar structures that the National Council and the World Council built, those are products of the 20th century. And they're realizing, in fact, the National Council of Churches is in a revisioning process now to try to retool its 20th century bureaucracy, which is sort of a little bit clumsy for today. It's not quite as nimble as they'd like it for a 21st century model. But the vision of ecumenism is timeless. One of the great books I've read recently was by Karen Armstrong. It's called The Great Transformation, and she writes about the axial sages that were around from, you know, 900 to 200 BCE, and that includes Jeremiah and Euripides and the Buddha and Confucius. And then if you want to spread, if you want to look, connect the vision up to about 600, 650 CTE, that would include Rabbi Hillel, the founder of Rabbinic Judaism, Jesus, and Muhammad. And all these people echo a vision, a worldview, a faith worldview that is exactly like the ecumenical churches. It's about the fact that none of us have a corner on the truth. We need each other. We need to operate more as a community. All is one. Love your enemy. That you need to speak truth to power. That justice is the cornerstone of peace. I mean, all these ideas are just eons old. And I think the ecumenical movement is just a 21st century manifestation of this. So absolutely, yes, that's not a dying idea. And I think these ecumenical folks, I think I'd like to close on this, is that the ecumenical idea is all about building unity and talking across divisions. And if you look at today, the partisanship, the fact that people are moving into silos to live around people that think and breathe and talk like themselves. The Congress can't even talk among their own divisions. And here are these ecumenists that do the bridge-building thing 24/7. They're good at it. And they can teach us something. And I think we need to root for them because they have a skill set that is direly needed today.
Well put. Jill Gill, professor of history at Boise State, thank you so much for your teaching, your scholarship at Boise State, and especially for this book, Embattled Ecumenism. Thanks for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Jill Gill. Next week, Robert Morgan, author of Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.